It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, with the recent announcement that one of Wisconsin's remaining drive-in theaters will be closing at the end of the season, we'll take a look at how the rest of the state's drive-ins are holding up.
First, news broke last week that a Virgin Galactic commercial spaceship had crashed in California's Mojave Desert, killing one pilot and hospitalizing another. The ship being tested was part of the company's venture into the new world of space tourism, which some expect to become a reality in the coming few years.
While the pilot's death is tragic, some are saying that it's just a price that has to be paid for humans to take the next step in space travel. But our next guest doesn't buy that. He says there's a big difference between practical space exploration and what Virgin is doing, and it's a mission he can't support.
Joining us now is Adam Rogers. He's the articles editor at Wired, and he recently wrote an op-ed there called "Space Tourism Isn't Worth Dying For." Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, in your piece, Adam, you say right up front you are fascinated by the idea of space and spaceships. You're not anti-space travel, but you say you can't support the idea of space tourism and what Virgin Galactic is doing. Why is that?
Well, I might even parse that further and say that I'm not even necessarily against space tourism. I think that sounds like it could be a lot of fun, although there aren't really a lot of destinations for it right now. But what I am, the question I do think we have to ask is whether, first of all, whether what Virgin Galactic is doing is actually space tourism or really just flying an airplane very, very high. And if it is, what connection it has to the kind of rhetoric that Virgin Galactic and the space tourism industry in general will employ, which is that they are trying to build the next step in human evolution and pave our pathway to the stars, all of which may be totally fine as well, except now we know that people are dying for that. And if you buy the rhetoric, then maybe that makes the risk something that you want to be part of. But I'm becoming less convinced that the rhetoric of what Virgin Galactic says they're doing is actually connected to what Virgin Galactic is really doing.
So how would you characterize what they're really doing?
Well, my sense from the way they themselves describe what the business is that it's what sounds like, if it worked, would be an amazing ride for some very wealthy people. And I'm not sure that I see the connection between that and space exploration.
Now, do you see other projects going on like SpaceX and others as more maybe valid paths toward what we think of when we think of the frontier of space exploration as compared to what you're saying is more a thrill ride in a way?
Yeah, I probably could identify those, although I'm not sure that I have the expertise to say which of them is going to be successful and which of them won't. I think it's pretty evident that what SpaceX is doing is designed to actually go into orbit, for example, and that while it doesn't start with tourism, it starts with a business model, which is getting NASA to pay for ISS resupply. And I think it's fair to point out there that SpaceX has, at least at one time, had a deal that they haven't talked about much in recent years with Robert Bigelow, who has a business trying to build inflatable space stations using some technology that NASA abandoned that they'd planned to use in conjunction with the space shuttle. So the idea, again, being that you have a destination for tourism that actually is in space, that's in orbit, and that becomes part of a larger plan that that Elon Musk has talked about, which is trying to get humanity off Earth and to the moon and to Mars for some reasons that I see as being very practical as well as very cool. I mean, I'm very much a science fiction nerd and a science reporter. I believe in this stuff. I just don't think that that's the same model that Virgin Galactic is espousing.
Well, is it possible that this suborbital thrill ride sort of concept may not really take us into space where we want to go, but it might be a viable business model that could solve some engineering problems and pave the way toward parts of the future of space travel?
Yeah, and I guess if it turned out that, in fact, a rocket launched from a high-flying plane was a way to get people and things into space at some point down the line, then I would be wrong. Sure. I mean, all I have to go on is what's in front of us right now. But I would also say that if what you're asking is, could there be spin-off technologies from this, then I would say there's got to be a better way to find those technologies than hoping that they spin off of something that is of a obviously dangerous, potentially futile. And if what you're asking, because another iteration of that question, another version of the question is, well, doesn't this at least get people excited about the idea of going to space? Doesn't it at least keep us committed as a people to the idea of a space program when our governments don't seem to be able to commit to one? Then I would say that what you're actually talking about there is a PR campaign. And again, there's nothing necessarily wrong with those, and I want to go to space too, but now somebody is dead because of that PR campaign. And that's the thing that worries me.
And there's been some writing in the media looking at the pilot here as a hero, maybe a martyr in the cause of future space exploration. Is that the wrong way to be thinking of the sacrifice the pilot made?
Well, listen, that's obviously a tragedy, and I that's the thing that made me want to write in the first place, was feeling the emotion very keenly of this death of a person who, I think it's safe to say, loved being a pilot and obviously assumed those risks, understanding what those risks were. I think it's possible, and I'm a little uncomfortable with arguments by analogy, but I'll make this one. We know as a society how to honor the sacrifice of a soldier who dies for his or her country, but still ask important questions about the war in which that soldier fought. I think those can be separate issues. What this person did was obviously assumed a lot of risk, did something heroic. The person who's been injured was the same thing. But that doesn't change the fact that we can still ask questions about whether what that company is doing is the right thing. And I think it's really important to pay attention to the fact of who, Scaled Composites, which builds the engines here, had a few years back 3 deaths as they were testing their rockets. The people who have died so far are not the rich people who are going to pay, presumably, for the privilege of doing this. They're the workers who are building the technology. That's who's being put at risk here, and that's who's taking the risks. That's who died. And I think we can still ask whether the ultimate technology is worthwhile without, I hope, without seeming like we're denigrating or putting down the people who've suffered for it, because I certainly don't mean to do that.
So as you've said, you are not opposed to space tourism, space travel, space exploration. What would be a worthier mission, one maybe worth the loss of life for knowing participants?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you're asking me to step pretty far into speculation, and I'll do it, but with the recognition that I'm a reporter who's covered this field for a long time. I'm not a person who actually does it, right? So you and I know exactly what that's worth. But I would say that you want to get off the planet, and you want to have a permanent, you want to be reaching toward a time when there are permanent settlements for humanity somewhere other than Earth, because we know that either because of something that human beings do or because of a naturally occurring event, something very bad is going to happen on this planet. Asteroids have wiped the planet clean before. They will do it again. And if we want to survive as a species and as a people and have our cultures survive, we have to have backup copies of ourselves somewhere else. That's what we should be aiming for. And that's, as I say, that is eminently practical and also really, I think, stirs the blood and the emotion. That's what I would like to see.
So this crash and this loss of life, some people have said, hey, this is just a setback for space tourism. It's not something that's going to end it altogether. Do you think we should pause and rethink the concept of what we're doing when it comes to space tourism and space technology?
I think that's a really important question, and I would say that the distinction that I'm trying to be crystal clear about, and it is certainly possible that I'm failing, is between the concept of space exploration and even the concept of space tourism and the fundamental concept of the business model that Virgin Galactic is pursuing. Virgin Galactic has a technology that is challenging to build and really cool on its own terms, but I think the connection to space travel, space tourism, space exploration is tangential at best. It flies, the plane that they have now, if they get it working, flies to the bottommost definition of what we would consider space. It doesn't go into orbit. It doesn't seem, except in the broadest sense, to have applications for going any further than it does. It's a thrill ride for rich people. That's the thing that I want to be asking questions about. If all it is to get people excited about going and getting to play astronaut in the hope that that's going to lead to those other programs, I think that's misguided.
Do you think we as a culture are as excited as you would like us to be when it comes to that pure mission of getting us out into space?
Well, I'm not totally... I don't know. This makes me feel like I lose my science and science fiction nerd bona fides when I say something like this, but I'm not totally convinced that the that we should be excited for exploration in space for its own sake. That's no pioneers or explorers have ever done that. Nobody goes just to go. Some people go just to go. I shouldn't say nobody. That's tarring with too broad a brush. But I would say that when we go, when we commit, what's the saying, blood and treasure, mm-hmm. for grand national or grand planetary goals, we do it not just because it's going to be awesome. We do it for a rationale. We do it because there's trade at the other end of it, or because there are cultural reasons, because there are scientific reasons. We do it because there's a benefit to the cost. And I do think there's a benefit to the cost of aerospace as a science, of space exploration, of space travel. Like I said, we need backup copies. We need a permanent human presence somewhere other than Earth. I think that's really important. But I would see us pursuing that.
All right, Adam, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
That's Adam Rogers. He's the articles editor at Wired. His piece on space tourism is linked over at the Central Time Facebook page. There was a time in American history when the best way to take in a movie was your local drive-in, whether you piled the entire family into the Bel Air or saw a double feature on your first date with that special someone. Seeing a movie under the stars was a special experience.
These days, though, drive-ins are getting few and far between. Many have gone out of business, and in Wisconsin, we're about to lose one of our few remaining drive-ins. Last month, the owners of the Kino Drive-In in Pleasant Prairie announced they'll be closing for good after 66 years of operation. And that got us wondering, how are Wisconsin's remaining drive-in theaters doing, and what does their future look like as Americans' movie-going habits continue to change?
Joining us now to discuss these issues is Charles Bruss. He's a Wisconsin drive-in historian. He's the writer and director of the new documentary, 41 Twin Outdoor Theater, Starry Skies and Silver Screen Memories. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So after decades of operation, the Kino Drive-In is calling it quits. According to their Facebook page, this coming weekend is going to be their last. What do you think did the Kino in?
Well, 35mm film has always been the standard for showing movies in theaters. And over the past 10 to 12 years, digital has become increasingly the way that movie companies are going. An average 35mm print to show in a theater is around $3,000 to $5,000 a copy. So when you times that by 3,000 to 4,000 theaters, you can see how much that is. Digital, I've heard that they can either do it with a satellite download, or it's basically an encrypted disc, you know, a regular digital CD disc, and $5, you know, so. It's all about cost for the film companies. So they basically warned all theaters, you know, 10, 12 years ago that this is coming and you need to switch your projectors to digital projection or you won't get film. So a lot of theaters, indoors and drive-ins, over the course of, you know, the past 10, 12 years have been slowly changing to the new format at a cost of about anywhere from $75,000 to $80,000 per projector. So if you have multiple screens, you can see how costly you can get. And for drive-in theaters, the projection booths, you know, a lot of them are like standalone little buildings in the middle of the field. Well, they also need to be heated, air-conditioned, sealed up completely because all the electronics that go with digital projectors are very sensitive to those kind of changes. So, you know, for, you know, drive-in, they'll have to spend at least another $5,000 just to get their booth up to speed, too. So it's a major cost, especially for drive-ins. And the Kino apparently has decided not to do it, and this is most likely going to be their last season.
Well, Charles, you're someone who loves drive-in theaters. What sorts of emotions are you going through when one like this closes down?
Oh, well, with the 41 Twin, that one closed in 2001. I got to work there the last 2 years it was open, and I got to see a drive-in from the inside out, not just as a patron. And so, you know, for me, you get a little more emotionally attached to the property. Each drive-in seems to have its own personality, if you will. It's the way it looks, feels. You know, memories are made there. You know, maybe you go there as a kid and you grow up watching all the movies and, you got your fond family memories. And, you know, basically now when the drive-in gets torn down, it's kind of like part of you gets ripped away, and it's sad. You know, it's sad that a drive-in has to get torn down all the way, you know, to make way for quote-unquote progress, just like we need another housing development or another office building, you know. But, you know, to me, it's just history. They've been around for so long, and they've shown so much film history of different genres. It's just sad to see it go.
So what is it about the experience of seeing a movie at a drive-in theater that makes it special?
Well, you know, indoor theaters, you know, here's your start time, you know, whether it be 7 o'clock, and you get in there, hour and a half later, it's like, get out, you know. Drive-ins, it's an experience. It's, you can get there, at, you know, when the gates open at 7. The movie usually doesn't start for a good 2 hours. A lot of people bring their ball and glove and frisbees and play on the in the front of the screens, and a lot of drive-ins, you know, in the States still have playground equipment, so you get to come out and let the kids run around and burn off their extra energy. And the food at the drive-ins, most of them are very, very good with their selections, and you know, and of course you get two movies for the price of one. You know, indoor theaters, it's $10 one movie. And in a lot of drive-ins still have like 12 and under free or 10 and under free, so it's more almost more economical for a family to go to the drive-in as opposed to going to an indoor theater.
And so we're losing the Kino, it looks like. How would you say the rest of the drive-in theaters are doing in Wisconsin, those that we have left?
They're all doing, from what I've heard, pretty good. The only one that hasn't converted to digital is the Twilight Outdoor in Chilton, Wisconsin. Although I was told 2 years ago that when I talked to the owners that, oh yeah, we'll switch, no, you know, no problem. They haven't switched yet, as the last I've heard. But if they said they're going to do it, I would assume they're going to do it. And one of the other drive-ins that I was worried about was the Stardust drive-in up in Chautauqua. The owner had socked away a lot of money 2 years ago, and he had a very bad spring, and he had to burn through a bunch of the money he had saved up for the projectors. But he switched one of the screens. He has a two-screen drive-in, so one of the screens went digital this year. So at least that ensures that he'll be able to get, you know, movies for next year. Because it's just really getting hard for, like, and I've seen the Kino this year really struggling to get the movies that they want to get, because they're just not making as many prints. So you basically have to wait, or they're just not making 35 millimeter prints at all. And then you're kind of shut out of the really big movies.
Do we moviegoers still want the drive-in theater option, or are we, you know, we've got so much home entertainment, and then there's still the indoor theaters, maybe we don't miss them so much?
I think it's the opposite of that. I think, you know, back in the 80s, you know, the drive-ins really took a hit. Their numbers, you know, went down by well over 1,000 in numbers over the course of that decade, partially because of real estate values and then people's changing views on, well, now we got cable TV, we got VCRs, we can stay home, and that was the case. But nowadays, I think families have really found the drive-in again, and the experience of getting together as a family and going to the movies, getting out of the house. You know, so I think the popularity of the drive-in has actually come back a lot. You know, in Wisconsin alone, we've seen drive-ins actually get built in this state. The Twilight Outdoor in Chilton was actually built on a Walmart property. The Walmart moved to a different area in town, and the drive-in was built on the parking lot of the Walmart. And usually it's the other way around. Walmarts are tearing down drive-ins because they're cheap land. And you know, so I don't know. I just, the popularity has come back. And I've seen a lot of people commenting on the closing of the Kino and how much they're going to miss it. And I think it's kind of a tragedy for the community to lose such a piece of history. But, you know, you never know. I guess until they actually come in with bulldozers to tear it down, there's always hope that it'll come back, you know, hopefully.
Now, it's getting easier these days to have a really good movie-watching experience at home. You can have your surround sound, your comfy sofa, lots of movies on demand. But it also, in a way, it sort of homogenizes the movie-making experience. Do you think that maybe the fact that we can watch movies like that at home could actually help drive-in theaters?
Well, you know, as far as sound and stuff goes, I mean, the audio for the movies comes over your car speaker or your stereo in your car now. So most people have, you know, almost Dolby sound in their car with, you know, kick and bass systems and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost like being in an indoor theater with the great sound. So I just think that the driving experience, you just can't beat it. People could, you know, say they want to sit home and watch movies in the comfort of their own living room. Well, and I say get out and enjoy the outdoors. You know, you just can't beat that experience.
Charles, I got to ask, what's the last movie you've seen in a drive-in most recently?
Oh, I was up at the Kino last weekend. Saw the original, well, not the original, but the remake of Halloween, the Rob Zombie version, which actually for a remake wasn't too bad. And then they showed Scary Movie 4 and Scream 4. Now, all those movies have been out for a while, and that's one reason why they were able to get prints, because, you know, the prints are still available. But, you know, it was Halloween weekend, and they went with three horror movies.
It's a great Halloween experience, Charles. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Charles Bruss. He's a Wisconsin drive-in historian, and he's the writer and director of the new documentary 41 Twin Outdoor Theater, Starry Skies, and Silver Screen Memories. Our next guests say we have a fundamental problem in our society, in our world. We're addicted to short-term thinking, and that makes it impossible to deal with long-term, slow-moving crises, things like climate change or economic inequality.
They also have a prescription, more history, and not just any history, though, long-term, big-picture history that's accessible to the public.
Our guests are both historians. Their new book is The History Manifesto. Joe Goldie is assistant professor of history at Brown University. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And David Armitage is professor of history at Harvard University. David, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, a specter is haunting our time, the specter of the short term. That's the opening line of your book. Joe, let's start with you. How are we as a society haunted by the short term?
We diagnose a crisis of short term thinking, characterized by quarterly return cycles, by thinking about elections at most every 5 years. And what we argue is that if you look at factors like climate change or global inequality, if you look at the crisis of international governance right now, all of those are issues that static models can't really help. Static models about what happens universally. You have to think over decades. Types of change that may take centuries to unfold. And this is a kind of thinking that we used to have in public culture that began to disappear. And so we think that this crisis of short-termism is the result.
And David, you also make the case that the history profession itself also has tended toward short-term thinking in its research and writing. How so?
That's right. For about 2,000 years, history was what one great Roman philosopher called the guide to life. To know about the past was to help to orient yourself in the present and to look to the future. But in the last 40 or 50 years, as historians have become professionals, they become very specialized. And to become specialized, they've had to focus, and to focus, they've had to narrow their timescales and their questions to ever more subtle problems to impress their peers, but thereby lost the touch with a broader public and also with big questions.
And David, is there a fear that if I go outside of my zone of history, I'm going to step on the toes of other people and get things wrong as I try to address those big picture issues?
Exactly. Every historian is supposed to say, that's not my period, and to keep other people off their turf when they try and invade it. And those pieces of turf have become smaller and smaller, from looking like great prairie fields, they're now down to the size of backyards or even bonsai trees.
And it seems like you're talking to two different audiences, historians and everybody else. So, Jill, let's start with the historians. What are you calling on from your peers in your profession?
We're asking historians to think about something that actually the profession as a whole has been thinking about anyway, which is contemporary issues like global climate change. So, you know, if you look at history books that were published for the last 30 years, you wouldn't find that much. But in the last 5 years, historians have started to cotton on to the fact that this may actually be a crucial set of problematics to which we have enormously important things to say, important things not only about the rise of an environmental movement and the rise of the EPA and then the descent of the EPA, but even on larger time scales, when was it with the Industrial Revolution or was it with agriculture as a whole that we started to produce this phenomenon? And then who should we blame? If we think that it's the Industrial Revolution, should we blame a handful of countries where that factor first emerged? If it's the beginning, if we blame agriculture, do we blame everybody? So we have a lot to say about who should pay for the cleanup around climate change. So we're hoping that we actually diagnose that we are seeing our fellow historians take these issues very seriously, and they're starting to write as if the public matters. They're starting to write as if the long-term matters. We didn't start that. We're merely saying that the profession as a whole has started to realize that they have something much greater to say.
David, that was the historian side. Now, can you make the case that the rest of us, the non-professional historians, the general public, policymakers, should be paying more attention to long-term history?
Absolutely, and this is the perfect day for doing that on the day of the midterms, of course, where we're locked into exactly one of those short-term cycles that Joe mentioned a few minutes ago, in a two-year electoral cycle where politicians and those they're pitching to citizens, are thinking in terms of very short-term advantage and making sure that they can be re-elected and thinking maybe to the next two-year cycle, but not thinking about the huge problems like climate change, for instance, which, of course, go well beyond the borders of the United States and have many, many complex factors going into them. Climate change, anthropogenic climate change, as we call it now, man-made, human-induced climate change, goes back at least to the Industrial Revolution and maybe goes back even tens of thousands of years before that. But we have to tackle it in the here and now as a comprehensive global problem with very deep roots indeed. And the crucial fact about this, to sell this as a historical problem to a broader audience, is to remember the great words of Winston Churchill, who said, the further you look back, the further you can look forward. We're talking about history not as a backward-looking discipline or a backward-looking interest for the general public, but something that helps us to orient ourselves into the future, to think about long-term problems and the long chains of consequences that got us where we are now, in order to think about the long future, a future not just for children and grandchildren, but for many generations beyond that.
Well, in your blog, the History Manifesto blog, Joe, the two of you wrote about, you know, ways to try to practically apply these things, and you look back at U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as one potential example where longer-term historical thinking might have been valuable for policymaking us here in the United States. Can you talk about that a little more?
Well, sure. When you hear policymakers talking about wars, they inevitably draw historical metaphors. So some during the lead up to the Iraq War talked about the war as an example to relive the greatest generation. The example would be stopping the spread of Nazism in World War II. Another set of thinkers talked about parallels between the Iraq War and Vietnam, entering a war that has no end. Now, from the public perception, maybe those two analogies bear equal weight. They're both interestingly fascinating parlor games that you could play. But for the profession, we now have, as a result of the Vietnam War generation of historians, an enormous swath of histories of empire that draw parallels between the European empires of the 18th and 19th century and their exploitation of engineering and slavery and 20th century empires, indeed in the form of America's presence in Latin America and Southeast Asia. And so we have books upon books that suggest that really the parallel between Iraq and Vietnam is the really clear one. That we are recreating patterns that we know very well, that we can establish and talk about in great detail. From the perspective of the profession, there is no question about which war Iraq resembled more. The answer is quite clear. It's Vietnam.
But I wonder, looking back at Vietnam, there are still debates today among historians, among think tanks and others over what the right lesson to learn from Vietnam was and probably the colonial era as well. David, how do we try to draw the right lessons from history, given that so much of it is contested?
Well, one of the things that historians can do is to lay out a different range of possibilities for thinking about these problems, not to take one example and say the present maps onto one example in the past, but maybe to give two or three different options. So to Vietnam, we'd want to add the Soviets in Afghanistan, or you'd want to add the British in Afghanistan in the 19th century, to look at different countries going into the same places, fighting similar kinds of wars, or you might even want to extend the whole telescope of time even further backwards. For instance, I'm working currently on a book about civil wars over 2,000 years, and one of the lessons of that is 2,000 years ago, the Romans realized that civil wars always recurred. They never really ended. They might disappear for a few years, and then they come back, and that's a very important lesson in the Iraq War as well. It was what looked like a civil war in 2005-2006. It seemed to go away a few years later. Now it's come back with even worse force than before. So we can see some patterns in history, but you need to look in different places at different times, not just for one-stop shop for a ready answer to what the historical analogy is, but a multiplicity of historical analogies to orient us towards potential multiple futures.
Joe, I wonder how this would play out in practice. Do we need a federal Department of Historical Lesson Providing, or do historians need to step up and be public intellectuals? How would this work?
Well, one of the things that we figure out as we look past the 30-year threshold, we think that this crisis of short-termism happened around 1968 with a turn towards shorter and shorter timescales, both in the public and in the profession in the university. And if you look before that, if you look to what was happening in the 1930s, the 1950s, the early 1960s, what you see is a policymaking apparatus in which anthropologists, sociologists, and historians are relied on as the advisors of policy. So historians rather than economists, rather than political scientists. So culturally sensitive models of change over time rather than static models which are supposed to apply universally to a system of incentives in various countries.
We're talking to Joe Goldie and David Armitage about short-term thinking and long-term historical lessons. Their new book is The History Manifesto.
We continue our conversation with David Armitage and Joe Goldie. In their new book, The History Manifesto, they make the case that we think, live, and act in the short term, and that we need a bigger diet of long-term historical thinking to address the problems facing the world.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you see us trapped in a world of short-term thinking? Do you think it's gotten us as a country, as a world for that matter, into trouble? Do you think we need to pay more attention to long-term history and the lessons it can provide? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Go right to a caller. We've got Nick on the line in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I appreciate the topic because one of the things that I hear so much is that the media, the news media, presents the news as though the world started last week Monday. A good example of that is the minimum wage. Now, they will report, oh, we're talking about raising the minimum wage from this to that. And then they put on somebody who says, well, that'll kill a lot of jobs. But if the media would also report that the last five times that the minimum wage was raised, it didn't happen that way.
All right, Nick, I want to get our guests in on his initial point there, David, that the news media often acts like the world started last week. Do you see that as you look at the news?
I think that's often observable, that the commentators who are brought on to talk shows, for instance, to put contemporary events in context tend to be generals or economists or politicians, not historians who can say we've been here before or we've seen analogies to this, or in something like the minimum wage, for instance, can give exactly the kind of parallels that Nick just mentioned there, but also to say why was the minimum wage put in place in the first place? How does this relate to larger questions of social justice, the protection of workers' rights, labor rights in the U.S. and in other places around the world as well? We need to remember the motivations for the beginnings of the minimum wage, as well as the consequences of its application over time.
And Joe, do you agree that we don't see that kind of deep historical context in the daily news we get?
Absolutely, and it doesn't even have to be that deep. It just has to be a consideration. I think Nick is absolutely onto something here. One of the books that we talk about in our book is Zachary Karabel's book, The Leading Indicators, which is a history of numbers like unemployment and the way that they're used. And one of the things that Karabel is so good at sketching is the way in which our unemployment numbers are themselves linked to social conditions from the 1930s. They are out of date for a non-agrarian society. And the kinds of claims that are made about them all the time in the news, even by the most deft of policy analysts, you know, no president has ever been elected when the unemployment rate is above 5%, for example, that there's no basis for extending those numbers before 1950 because we didn't even have those numbers. So for most of American history, you're talking about making up a universal law on the basis of a handful of decades of evidence. And so that's really, it's beyond dangerous. It's beyond dangerous that to reduce all policy information to slippery readings of the present in terms of these numbers without a bigger context. You end up recreating a world that looks exactly like it did yesterday. All of the other horizons start to contract and disappear, and you're left in a world with no change, no utopias. It's not so great a world, and it's a world that we have built largely out of those numbers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Nick. We'll go now to Matt in Portage. Matt, hi.
Hi, guys. I was going to say, I think most of the public era, we're just generally ignorant of history. Like, we know more about what Kim Kardashian is wearing versus what's going on in history. And I think it's kind of like a Roman Empire circus and bread type environment where we just want to be entertained. We just want to, you know, we know more about food and fashion than we do about where we've come from in our history. So that's all I have to say about that. Thanks.
Matt, thanks. Some blame, I think, for the public there, Joe, in wanting to know about the fads and fashions of today more than the history of the past and the prospects for the future.
Well, you know, I think we would all love to. I think we would all love to know more about everything, and there are only so many hours in the day. But whenever we turn on the news, I mean, the people who are listening to us right now or people who listen to NPR, you know, I remember we were talking about this book in London, and there was a sort of shocked look on one of the students, and he said after the seminar, he said, you know, I read your book, and then I was listening to the radio, and it was just like you said, all of the people on the radio were economists. No one was interviewing a historian, and he had never thought about it that way. So the consideration is, what would your day look like? What would your understanding of the news look like if they were interviewing a historian instead of an economist? Though, of course, we would say that. Like, you know, we want to hang out on the radio, too.
And David, following up on that point, and Joe's mentioned a couple times the static view that we get, you know, economics often works in immutable laws, as Joe pointed out. We also see explanations in evolutionary biology showing why our culture functions exactly like it does at this time. Is that a problem? Does history help solve that problem, if so?
Absolutely. It can break a kind of gridlock and determinism that's encouraged by the models of evolutionary biology. We're trapped in our genes. We're on certain paths which we can't escape just because of our bodies and our biology. Or the economists would say that we're dependent on certain paths. We're locked into a single future, and we're locked into a single model of human psychology. We're locked into a single model of the market. Historians can say those are just models. They're not complex enough. They don't fit the dizzyingly complex realities of the human past, and that opens up the possibility again of many futures emerging out of many pasts as well, that we're not locked into one future. As Joe says, utopian thinking becomes not just fanciful thinking, but something that's liberating. It allows us to imagine different futures on the basis of the multiple paths that we know that we've emerged from.
Back to our callers now. We've got Jack on the line in Viola. Jack, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, a quick comment. Back in 1981, when I was in economics class in UW-Madison, the professor and I used to argue. I argued for long-term, a look at things and costs and so forth, externalities, they call it now. And he just argued with me about morals and everything. He just argued that greed is good and short run was it. And we argued and argued. And he finally said, Jack, basically, in the long run, we're all dead. And that was the end of the argument. It was all about short interest. And that whole supply economics thing of the Reagan revolution has led us to where we're at now.
Interesting, you know, Jack. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. Joe, are we just so interested in what's in it for us that we don't pay attention to a time span before we were born and after we die?
Well, Jack, the great thing about your question is that when you were sitting in that classroom in 1980, you were living through a historical moment. You were living through a transformation as part of this swing from historians, sociologists, and anthropologists as the major advisors of policy. We talk about this in the book. The people who were advising the planners of cities, the makers of wars, the maker of policy towards China, to economists and to this model. And it was very, very important about the rise of what many analysts now call neoliberalism, a certain form of capital that stresses no regulations whatsoever, that the market is the one just system of allocation. It's very important to that model of the market that there not be history, that we talk in terms of an ideal form of market forces. And as we explain in the book, it's interesting to look at what those people say when they try to look at history, because many of them have written books of history, I think, for example, of Gregory Clark. But they, from our perspective as professional historians, they get the history wrong. They leave out the voices of workers, of the working classes, of women. And so the numbers that they look at, and we cite many examples of this, including examples by economists themselves, the numbers that they get for what the Industrial Revolution looked like end up massively skewed. To conform with ideology. You can look at them again and see that really there's a manipulation going on.
And David, as we start to wrap up, if we the public are going to take this historical long view, we probably need you, the historical professionals, to write in ways that are approachable to us, not jargon laden, not written just for your peers. Are historians doing this, and are they doing it maybe more than they used to?
Absolutely. We've seen a sea change in the last few years of historians going back to the big picture, the big questions, big data, thinking about ways to present new forms of stories, big long-term narratives about the rise and fall of war or similar long-term complexes in economics, in politics, in the environment, in nature, for instance. I think we're actually on the verge of a renaissance of big history, of many different kinds that everyone can look out for, and it's going to be as fascinating, as riveting, and as important, even as the antics of Kim Kardashian.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And Joe, thanks to you as well.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
We've been talking to Joe Goldie. She's assistant professor of history at Brown University, and David Armitage, professor of history at Harvard University. And we've been talking about their new book, their new manifesto. It's called The History Manifesto.